What's up, guys? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety, the podcast and YouTube channel, translating health and safety to help you save money and save lives in your business. So if you're new here, hit the subscribe button and the bell if you're on YouTube. And if you like this episode, at the end, give us a rating, give us a review and a share. That would be awesome. Today we're talking all about how to manage compliance records, health and safety records, with Matt Hodges Long, the expert in that, because he owns a piece of software on it, which obviously he's going to tell you about. So let's dive straight into the podcast.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
We're in an oppressive regime of health and safety regulation.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranding Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. And your host, James McPherson.
Okay, so we all pretty much know, everyone that listens to the podcast knows that I'm a massive advocate of kind of reducing the amount of paperwork that we have in our businesses. But in short, there is an importance of having records and keeping records, and in some cases, it's a legal document. I suppose that's what we're going to talk about today. Today we've got Matt Hodges Long, co-founder and CEO of Track My Risk. So welcome to the podcast, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
That's okay. Thank you very much for coming on. Do you want to take us on a little journey, Matt, of kind of where you started and how you came to be the co-founder and CEO of Track My Risk, and take us on a little story?
Okay, I'll try and do the expedited version, because it could take the whole podcast just to talk through the history of that. In short, started off in construction. Had a very near miss on a site that I was running that luckily nobody got killed or seriously injured, but caused a lot of property damage and a big insurance claim. That sort of first switched me on to the whole sort of risk management piece. Number of years went by, got into technology through different routes, the early stage of the internet, and ended up sort of then combining my property background with internet, online listings and sales of commercial property. And then the Buntsfield oil fire happened, and I had a sort of a deluge of calls from customers sort of saying, look, you know, we're now out, you know, we are damaged, we need to get back online, can you help? And then from that sort of got into providing specific services around work area recovery and that sort of thing. So that's where my sort of world of getting involved then with business continuity people, a lot more sort of risk managers, health and safety happened, along with the technology. And this business sort of grew out of that experience, although it's a different business with a different business partner. That's where the sort of the original idea came from. And we just found that as we got more and more into working with companies and sort of said, well, look, where are your records? Where's a copy of your fire risk assessment? Show us your business continuity plan. You know, where's your current insurance policy? Let's have a check of all of this. We found that nobody could evidence that in a kind of a, yeah, here it is, 20 seconds later, there's the information you want. It was always, I need to go and speak to Deirdre, but Deirdre's on holiday because she looks after that bit, and this bit's over here, oh, I can't find that one, or this one's 3 years out of date, or whatever. So we got to think, actually, this small element of what we were building in Track My Risks for the sort of document management and, bless you, the document management and evidential piece, which was only ever going to be a tiny bit, became the thing. And the rest of our roadmap going forward got slowed down, so we could actually capitalize on the opportunity to sort the documentation and the evidence out. So we sort of came up with this concept of a system of record. And our view now is, if it's not in there, it doesn't exist. And that's the sort of the mantra that we have with clients, and say, if you need it, it's there. If it's not there, let's assume it doesn't exist. And then that's the way we move forward. And then it becomes very obvious to say, does that organization have that underlying control or that policy? You can always debate whether it's, you know, fit for purpose after the event, but let's first of all see if we can find what we should have. And that's sort of really where the whole sort of concept was born from. And it's grown up since.
So I suppose you kind of touched on that kind of messy nature that we have around record keeping. Yeah. And it's always someone else's job or someone else's document. And from my experience as being a fire risk assessor, I was doing normal health and safety, you know, back in the day in like manufacturing, it seems to be this kind of continuous trend we're in, maybe as a nation. But then on the flip side, they go to a lot of businesses and there's just way too much paperwork. So like, what's the middle ground?
We tend to look at the statutory documentation, the must-haves, and then you get into your kind of your important and best practice stuff and contextual stuff, and then you get into your sort of spurious, not spurious, but you know, discretionary type of control documentation. Then it's a question of looking at it and saying, well, how rigidly do you need to manage this? So if for example the marketing team were, they could back the marketing plan back and forth on our platform in a controlled manner with type permissioning, activity logging and everything like that. But I would suggest that that's probably overkill to deal with that kind of thing. But until it becomes something that's needs to be in the system of records. So let's say from a governance perspective, that marketing plan then forms part of a investment round. So at that point, that marketing plan needs to be fixed and controlled because it's part of a sort of a legal bundle of documentation. Mm. So we're very much about the system of record, not so much the production of documentation, not the, you know, the back and forth and the sort of pre-versioning. But when something becomes version one, then that's a version controlled document that should be in the system of record and then appropriately shared with the right people. But it's always a difficult point because we do a lot of work in schools, for example, and we see, you know, if we're permissioned into their environments, we see hundreds and hundreds of pieces of controlled documentation. Sometimes you can look at the headings and go, really, is that really that important? But I think what's more important is the organization believes it's important. Whereas quite often there'll be something that they require legally that they don't have. So at that point, if they ask us to critique whatever they've uploaded, I mean, I must admit that, you know, I must say that we don't by default see what customers are uploading into our platform. So it's only when they say, could you have a look at what we've done? They invite us in and then we can give them a few pointers. So yeah, you do get a proliferation. So sort of an average school, you're looking at about 200 or 300 pieces of unique controlled documentation that they're tracking in quite a small school, usually on a spreadsheet with somebody that's trying to do their best. And a lot of it gets missed. So yeah, we take all of that ambiguity out of the process and then give proper evidence to the governors and trustees and the regulators and the head that things are being dealt with appropriately and on time.
I suppose a big thing for me, it sounds like it kind of gives confidence to the board and stuff like that. So if I think, like, I always kind of put myself in the position of the council the day after Grenfell, the morning they wake up, they put the nudes on and they realise, shit, that's my building. You know, you want to have that confidence to be able to know where everything is. And I suppose maybe the problem is not really the amount of paperwork you have. Is it the fact that they don't know they've got that much paperwork because it's all in so many different places and there's so many different versions. And maybe, well, I think what you're saying is maybe if it was one controlled system and software or whatever, one place that you monitor and you can see, then you know how much you've got. So I suppose maybe it's a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you sort of, you know, it's right to mention Grenfell's. We sort of come up to the second anniversary and, you know, I think the I put something on LinkedIn about it the other day around the fire service saying that they couldn't find the firebox in the reception and, you know, where the plan should have been, etc. And I think my observation was one that, yeah, it's terrible it wasn't there. But secondly, what century are we in that we're looking for a metal box in a burning building with bits of paper in it? You know, we have the ability right now to digitize all of that information, make it available all of the time, keep it properly version controlled and also simulate against that. You know, why can't a fire service sitting in a conference room run a simulation that a large high risk residential building's on fire? Can we get the information, ping 20 seconds later, yes, we're in. We're simulating, not turning up in a fire engine and knocking on the door and walking around and saying, you know, I think all of that stuff's important, but we shouldn't leave this sort of thing to surprise. You know, I think it was, I'll choose my words carefully, but certainly less than correct that that behaviour, not wanting to prejudice anything that's going to go through the court. But, I think we will see change. I'm pretty disappointed at the progress with the, post-Hackett. Seems to me that it seems quite opaque, that whole process of implementing the Hackett recommendations, assuming that the Hackett recommendations were fit for purpose. And I think there's different schools of opinion on that. But certainly the bit that I would see around the golden thread and the system of record, guys, just do it now. Start it now. Stop prevaricating. Thinking about what technology you might use and how you might do it and et cetera, et cetera. There's 3,500 buildings out there at the moment that need this now. Bloody well do it. Even if you bin it later and change it for something else, get it done. My guess would be that a lot of those landlords or responsible persons will not be able to find the correct suite of risk control documentation for each of those buildings. That's my guess based on what I've seen up until now. I hope I'm wrong, but there will be massive inconsistencies in the record keeping, and it doesn't need to be that way.
No, you're right. And it's such a big thing, I think, Grunfo, and it, like you say, it's hard for us to comment, and we can only really give our opinions and based on our own experience. But I think you're right in what you say about Hackett. The progress is slow, but I think the progress is misguided to a point where I think we focus in on the wrong things. I think Hackett's style and her style kind of continues in that document is all around culture. I think a lot of people forget that she's referring to two different industries there. She's referring to build, construction, and maintenance, housing. Mm-hmm. And they're two completely different industries and two completely different processes that join at one point. But ultimately, they're both responsible people. Like you say, one's responsible for the build, one's responsible for the maintenance of the property. But Grenfell wasn't built yesterday. And as much as, yes, it was refurbed, quite recently prior to the fire, it was not built yesterday. And there is no way, in my opinion, that should have happened. And there's no way, and people that I've spoken to, fire engineers, fire risk assessors, fire service people, that should not have happened. The lady that was the head of training on the inquiry said that, if someone come to me and said, let's do a simulation for Grenfell, let's create a building and train if that happened, she said, I would have said no. And I thought, fair play to her, standing up and saying that after Grenfell, that takes some balls. And to admit that just was not reasonable, that was not feasible for that to have happened. But you are right to a point where, if it does happen, whether it's a small fire or a big fire, we should immediately know where we are, what we've done, and how we are. That confidence piece and that kind of compartmentation records, building plans that we've got from the construction industry and all that kind of thing. And it's having it in that one place, which we are just horrendous at. It's just, I feel frustrating from my point of view that it's not difficult. But I think, and we'll come on to track my risk definitely, but I think we might end up coming onto it now actually. But I think in my opinion, there's a lot of software out there, but it's all right. This is for example, marketing software. This is the finance software, and this is the health and safety software, and this is the compliance software. This is the HR software. There's not here's a business software, if that makes sense. Or there may be, but I don't know. And if there is, you need to be shouting louder, and maybe that's what you're about to do. But that kind of, that one business solution.
I think I'm a firm sort of advocate in sort of specialist software, but I think there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't integrate with each other. So, for example, I wouldn't, although my platform can be used for basic sort of customer relationship management, CRM, if you need to do that properly, then go and get yourself Salesforce or something like that. If you want accounting, go and get Xero or, whatever. Our initial thought was that, if I want marketing or automation, I can go to HubSpot. If I want team collaboration and software, I can go to Jira and Atlassian, et cetera, et cetera. But when I want to manage governance, risk, and compliance activity as a process within an organization, it's like, well, I go to an Excel spreadsheet typically. or I just don't do it, or I do it patchily, you know. And really, when you look at all of those things, if you get your sales and marketing wrong, yes, commercially that can be really damaging because you don't sell enough. If you get your governance, risk and compliance wrong, you can go to prison or people can die. But you haven't taken that as seriously as you take your accounting software or your whatever, you know. So get your arse in gear, get it sorted, suck it up. Nobody likes doing it. Get it done. Sleep easier, because then if you are that, you know, you are one of the unlucky ones that has an incident, at least you know that you're not going to be found wanting for your record keeping. You know, and we deal with lots of companies that come to us and say, oh, we just failed a, you know, a regulatory inspection on our record keeping or whatever. We couldn't find X, Y, and Z. Could you help us organize that so we can find it when we need it? Yes, absolutely. This will stop you from letting it go out of date and beyond its expiry. This will evidence the fact that those 12 people that need to see this whenever you reissue it have engaged with that underlying document. Oh, very easy. Get it set up and it kind of runs itself. But you've got to get off your ass and want to do it in the first place, which is quite often where we come up against problems, is that just people have the right intention but can't be bothered. Or, you know, that's probably a bit unfair, but for whatever reason within their organization, they don't devote enough time to getting it set up. But a lot do, you know, but we can't force people to do it. All we can say is that if you can't evidence this stuff and you're sitting in front of a judge or a regulator, then your life is going to be a hell of a lot more stressful than it should have been if you'd have bothered to actually populate this information. So, you know, crack on. But yeah, it's a difficult one. It doesn't seem to get taken as seriously as I think you would expect this subject matter to be taken. And maybe that sort of come through in Grenfell, that it was all a bit laissez-faire, even though you've got a very high risk building there full of a lot of vulnerable people. You know, they should have been on it, I would imagine, far more than they were or appear to have been.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose it's only right to say that there's a hell of a lot more complexities around Grenfell that I suppose will come out as the inquiry progresses on. And housing is a unique beast, I will give it that. But I think to a point, I think you're right, is that in every industry, where, you know, I recorded a podcast yesterday that will come out in a few weeks around emergency planning, and it was around, I think it was around actually a story you shared on LinkedIn, that care home fire that happened in 2017 in Hertfordshire.
Oh, right, Newgrange, yes, yeah.
Where they got, they finally got their fine a few months ago. And I just look at it and I thought, my first reaction was, not very big fine, but the second reaction was we seem to forget, and this is what I think you were touching on, was that these are lives. You know, these are people's grandmas, brothers, sisters, mothers. You know, these are people's family, people's friends, these are people that have touched other people's lives, and you would have touched their lives, that you're putting at risk. You know, nobody starts a business, or nobody goes into a business to kill someone. Well, hopefully not a lot of people do, but no one goes in to do a bad day's work. It's just that kind of complacency, I think. And we've become so inherently safe in our daily basis in the UK and other kind of major countries, well, pretty much around the world, to be honest. You know, we've become so inherently safe in what we do that when it comes to the real risk, we seem to forget, because we just think, oh, everything's just safe nowadays. I think maybe it's that realization. And I would hope that Grenfell would have opened our eyes to that. But like you said earlier, I don't think we're switching on. I went to a housing conference a few months ago, and it was with the NFCC, the National Fire Chiefs Council, were given this piece. And to be, all they did was just bash the Hackett report because it didn't regulate sprinklers and all this, whatever. And then there's a Labour government, Labour people came on and they just bashed Tories, and then Tories came on and they just bashed Labour. And I said, we're not getting anywhere here. And we finally got to a Q&A, and all people asked was, when you regulate sprinklers, we'll do it, essentially, is what they were saying. But none of them had done it. And they were all asking questions around, should we do it? And the answer was always yes for a lot of these properties. And is the answer to install sprinklers everywhere? I don't think so. Compartmentation is an unbelievable, amazing system, but you've got to maintain it. And it's that kind of, it's that kind of process. We just seem kind of naive, I think maybe is the best word.
Yeah, I think you're entirely right about the fact that very few people sort of set out in the morning to kill people, and thankfully it doesn't happen that often, you know, in the grand scheme of things. But you know, if you are one of those people that doesn't dodge the bullet, so to speak, and you know, statistically there will be some, there are fires, there are floods, there are explosions or whatever, then you know, you've at the very minimum, you've got to make sure that you've got your paperwork in order, that you've got your ass covered, basically. Also, that you're managing the risk effectively, because, you know, you still, even if you are technically not culpable, it still wouldn't be in a nice position to be in, that, you know, owning a care home where X number of people died in a fire. So I think as long as you know that you did everything that you possibly could prior to the event, then I think you probably sleep easier at night, you know. And then there's, because there's always that sort of gray area between, are you culpable enough for enforcement, you know, and you, the bar is quite high, as was one of the, an ex HSE litigator once said to me, when I sort of said, I asked her what their win ratio was, and she just sort of laughed at me and said, well, we never lose because we only prosecute the cases we're going to win. I won't say her name, but I thought that was a very good point. So, I mean, I think from a defensibility perspective, if you can turn around and say, well, look, here's my historical control paperwork, you know, all of the dates line up, everything was done, you know, we took all reasonable steps, then I think you're probably going to introduce enough ambiguity into the case for them potentially not to want to prosecute. Doesn't bring those people back, but at least, you know, perhaps your business will continue. I mean, that's one of the things that if you look at the HSE enforcements, and then you actually look at the survivability of companies that receive a large HSE fine, there is a huge spike in company failures post post fine, because, you know, you mentioned that that was quite a small amount of money, yes, but in the context of a very low margin, potentially barely profitable care home, that's probably game over. Who knows? I don't know about that company. I haven't looked into them. But for a lot of them, they just about manage. So if you hit them with a 50 grand, 100 grand fine or whatever, that's probably, you know, index for that business.
Fair point.
You know, it's just nuts. You know, it probably could have been avoided, you know, with that one, with a bit of evacuation planning and, you know, understanding what you're going to do in the event of a fire, then, you know, they probably could have got those people out. That was my read of the situation.
Yeah, mine was the same.
Just, yeah, it's just crazy.
It is, yeah. And I think that's a fair point about the fine. The sentencing guidelines does obviously take that into account. And I suppose it's worth mentioning, well, without repeating the podcast that is going to come out in a few weeks, that they're going to get smashed with civil claims as well. And I suppose for anyone that doesn't know, it's the criminal one is beyond reasonable doubt, which is obviously why the HSE won't take it unless they can prove beyond reasonable doubt you've done everything that's reasonably practicable with the business. But they're two woolly phrases there, aren't they? Like, beyond reasonable doubt, reasonable, okay, what's that mean? Well, that depends on the judge and the jury and the evidence. And then you've done everything that was reasonably practicable. You're like, whoa, hang on a minute. So that's, you know, obviously why the HSE are quite rightly pick their fights, as anyone would. And then from a civil law point of view, it is much easier to get through. You know, it's the balance of probabilities and that sort of thing. That's the right phrase. And that, which is much easier to prove. And I think from a documentation point of view, I would always say when I was doing fire risk assessment, I could probably tell in about 5 minutes whether it's going to be a good assessment or a bad assessment based on a few questions. One would normally be, have you got a fire strategy? Probably one of my first questions, so that I can have a look at that over a cup of tea, have a nice conversation with them, and then we'll go for a walk around the building. 9 times out of 10, first answer was no. Okay, I've got the old fire risk assessment. Oh yeah, it's in here somewhere. 1 second, big filing cabinet open, and you're like, it's going to be a bad day. It's going to be a bad day. It's going to be a long day. And you look at that and I think people are here in hospital trying to stay alive and you're potentially putting their lives at risk. You may not be, but me as a fire risk assessor don't know that. So I don't know because you've not got these documents. So I'm always going to resort back to a risk averse position because I have no information. And I think we as business owners create ourselves a difficult situation because we force the fire risk assessor, we force the fire risk assessor into a position where they have to raise a lot of stuff because they've got no information. And that's why you have those significant findings, which snag in list essentially of a building. And we force a fire assessor into a position because, like you said earlier, we just don't have visibility of any of the stuff that you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've got to assume that it doesn't exist, haven't you? As I sort of said at the start, you know, if you can't find it, it's useless. Mm. I'll assume it's not there. And you know, but if you've got those headings of things that you need in your system of record and they're grey because they're not there, then you can follow those steps to fill them up, you know, and then you've got something that you've got formal review dates on, you've got visibility and you know that the people that need to see it can see it. And I think that's a key point rather than something being sort of lost in a filing cabinet or in a dusty kind of network folder somewhere that someone else has moved. And, you know, is 25 layers of clicking into folders deep before you find the thing that you need. And then is it backed up or whatever? And that's certainly a million miles away from, you know, the gold commander saying, I need a copy of that fire strategy right now because I'm putting people into that building, or I need to see the plans because, you know, I need a structural engineer to review this to tell me whether I can go up above a certain floor or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, where are the dry risers? Where's this? Where's that? But the question I was going to ask you, James, actually, is when you found that sort of vague answer to the first question, did that typically lead into, you know, the sort of maintenance records being in pretty shit order as well, you know, in terms of, you know, when were those fire extinguishers last serviced? When was there, you know, did you normally find other things as a result? Was that a leading indicator or?
9 times out of 10, yes. I always found that things that are visible are managed, things that are not visible are not managed. So I always found 9 times out of 10 extinguishers were regularly serviced nearly all the time because they're visible, they're there, the record is on the extinguisher. And I always found they were probably one of the best performing areas. Things like maintenance records of alarms, that's when you start dropping down, I think. Or they get a bit airy. If you've got like a big system, like a big hospital or something like that, a contractor normally would service 25% every quarter as opposed to 100% in one visit because it's just this massive area. And when you start actually drilling down into that, they'll give you 4 sheets of paper, but are they the right order? And do they start matching up? And you just start building this picture that you're trying to have a grasp on the property, but you haven't. But if you haven't got that fire strategy, you don't really know what you're looking for. So yes, in answer to your question, 9 times out of 10, it does normally set a tone. But in defense to a lot of businesses, a fire strategy as a document is notoriously difficult to get. So I've gone to a lot of properties that don't have a fire strategy, even if it's a brand new building, and they still have all the maintenance. So that one document doesn't set the tone, but normally within the next 2 or 3 questions or conversations, you know it's going to be a bad day. And it's if you're not servicing the alarm, 9 times out of 10, you're not servicing everything else. Dry risers, I find dry risers are easily missed a lot of the time. I think people don't really understand what they are. When you go into housing, you've got other complications that Back in the day when you didn't lock the dry risers, they were notorious for people hiding drugs up there. They would, quite interestingly, they would hang them down from the top. So you go up to like the first or second floor and you would put your drugs in there on a piece of string, hang it down. And then you would go down to the inlet on the first floor and they would put like needles and sharps in there so you can put your hands in there. So
New world.
Housing is a beast, and that's why I mean it's all new to me.
Yeah, okay.
And it's interesting, but like when you hear some of these stories, and you just like you can really start to understand how something like Grenfell actually came to happen, and it is just a really fascinating industry. But in We've got to drill it down to its basis form. What is this? We are selling properties. That's what we're doing. Whether we rent them out, lease them out, or private sell them, we are selling properties. So would you sell a car that's not maintained? No, you wouldn't. So why would we sell a property that's not maintained? It's the same thing. It's your asset. And it's different as well. I find, sorry, I'm kind of talking a bit more. It's supposed to be me interviewing you. I find as well, if you go to like, different industries have different priorities, quite rightly. If you go into like the NHS, into like healthcare, their clinical records are normally spot on. You know, they go in and their clinical records are normally just down to a T. And if you get a good matron, as much as everyone thinks that role is kind of redundant now and it doesn't happen, other than in Carry On films, a matron is, if you get a good matron, it's a game changer. They save, they're awesome. And they just keep that clinical side going, but they also keep their hand on the building maintenance side. I find when you split them and you have clinical and estates, it starts to slip a little bit, which you'd think should be the other way around. But I think it's because if you have it tied into that clinical role, they know and understand who it affects because they have that ownership of the patients and therefore they take ownership of the hospital. That's just my interpretation of it. And that might be completely wrong. It might be right. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's interesting your take on records because, you know, the few times that I've sort of touched the NHS from a patient perspective with family members, that's typically where we've had the issues has been with record keeping, clinical record, or the handover of records between hospitals. That's typically where it falls down because, you know, everybody seems to have their own record keeping system. And then if you move between hospitals for whatever reason, you end up, I think, finding the family have to fill in the blanks for everybody.
Oh, for sure.
Which I thought was a bit bad. And then the other issue I have with that is we do a lot of work around data protection. And it's an interesting point that the amount of information that's in a paper record and the lack of security around that paper record. So when my mum was in hospital, we would just literally sort of go and grab her records from outside in the corridor and we'd rifle through them and find out what was going on and read them, you know, and it's sort of, well, you know, data breach, here we go. You know, anybody could do that. But, you know, I haven't got a solution for that, by the way. I don't want to start. But yeah, it's interesting that, I think that kind of organisation quite often does rely on people doing an exceptional job despite the system. And thankfully, most of them do. And I think they're, you know, the NHS are wonderful, teachers are wonderful, and all that sort of stuff. But I just sort of feel we should be helping those people to do their jobs in a more effective way. And I think technology can really help there. But it doesn't have to be a 25 billion new NHS IT system or whatever like that. You know, there are plenty of platforms out there that could really help do bits of that process better.
I think what you have to remember with the NHS is, and this might highlight the issue that you kind of went through, is that a lot of people think the NHS is the NHS. It's one organisation, but each area has a collection of trusts. So I live in Northamptonshire, and Northamptonshire would have NHFT, and then the General Hospital, Northampton General Hospital, that's its own trust with its own estates team. Kettering General, which is another local town, that's got its own trust. So they're all different businesses in essence. And as per any other kind of industry, handing records from one business to another business is always just messy. And you try doing that in a hospital environment, it's even worse. And I think that's where it falls down. So let's say, for example, I was still working in the NHS and I was like, you know what, Matt, track my risk is exactly what we need. I'm going to take this for the trust I work for. Now, I can't make the trust next door take that on.
Yeah.
But what we need is like kind of that the governmental decision or the NHS England decision. You're all going to take this because we want one system to talk to each other and work together. Now, it doesn't mean you as a people need to work together because we acknowledge that you are two separate businesses, but the system at least should work together. And a good example of that happening is in the NHS having awesome because it's got its own problems, but it has a reasonably good incident reporting system, Datex. Now, a lot of nurses that might listen to this or doctors or anything like that, they'll fucking hate Datex, but from my
they'll
point
be throwing
of view,
rocks at their iPhones or whatever they're listening on. Yeah.
But Datex, they talk to each other. So NHFT, for example, would raise a Datex, and all the other trusts that are connected with NHFT would see that. So if there was an incident in their hospital, the people in that hospital that are a tenant essentially would be able to see that or go and find it. And that was good. It's not great. It could be much, much better, but it's just a good example of how we could be better.
We had in schools, I was talking to a head teacher of a primary school a few weeks ago, and I sort of said to her, well, a client of ours, and said, so just talking through, you know, talking about health and safety as one area of that she has to manage. And I said, well, so where do you get all of your, how do you know what to do? You know, how do you know what the law is? How do you know what you need to do around managing health and safety effectively? And she said, well, I just kind of speak to my other colleagues, other heads around the area. Occasionally I get something from the local council that they might update me. I read something in the newspaper, whatever, and I kind of cobble it together. And I said, well, how do your other heads around here do it? And they said, well, they all do the same thing. So you've got all these little sort of cottage industries, effectively, these little islands of, you know, I was sort of expecting this benevolent management layer at the local authority or whatever that would say, okay, I've got 48 schools in my patch. This is what they all need. I'm going to manage their compliance for them, whatever. No, this is, you're ahead. You've got somebody on the governor's who's notionally responsible for health and safety as well, or risk. And between you, you're going to try and do your best to keep all of these kids safe and the other stuff. And I thought, this is just outrageous. Surely there must be a structured approach to this that's consistent and transparent. And then I sort of think, no, stop it. You know, stop thinking about how things should work in the perfect world or could work. You know, this is reality, but it just seemed, what a massive deviation from teaching kids how to read and write and be responsible human beings when you're spending more time thinking about, do I need a fire risk assessment? When do I need to do it again? And do I need this? And do I need that? You know, these people are educators first, you know, that then get sort of thrown this other responsibility in the same way that they've got to, you know, and they were talking about letting contracts for people to come and mow the lawns and the fields and things. And, you know, I thought all of this administration and, you know, going out and getting your own contractor and due diligence and, you know, all of that stuff, risk assessment, this isn't educating, you know, why are they doing all of this non-educational stuff? But it seems to be repeated up and down the land, you know, and it's sort of, so I think definitely we can help with that. And I think by templating it, it really does simplify it to a degree, but it doesn't do it for them. Unfortunately, it doesn't take all of the pain away, but it certainly helps.
I suppose that's a good point then to kind of start talking about track my risk then. So I suppose let's start with the question, you know, what was the moment that you thought, track my risk fills the gap? Was there a gap? You know, what was that kind of light bulb moment where you thought, this is what we need, this is what the world needs or the business industry needs or whatever, and I know how to do it?
So I think we knew that, so Richard and myself, it was Richard, my co-founder, we worked together sort of 16 years ago. He ran digital web design agencies, and we kept in touch, and we both sort of at the right time to sort of say, well, let's get together and do some kind of business, technology business. And, it, you know, I'd been working in that sort of risk management area around the world with people like Regis for a number of years. and we sort of got talking about what were the missing ingredients. So the first one was that in smaller businesses, there was nobody to call if you had a problem. So you had some kind of incident, you're effectively on your own to deal with it. And we came up with this whole concept that, you know, if you break down on the motorway in your car, most people ring the AA or the RAC or green flag, and an expert comes to help and certainly takes them to a place of safety or fixes it or whatever. So in a business context, we came up with the idea that, why don't you call us, subscribe to our service, and we'll be like the AA for businesses, and we'll help you fix the problem and all that sort of stuff. So that's sort of concept number one. Distribution is a problem with that. You know, we knew we could do it, but when somebody calls you, so for example, if your Ford Focus breaks down and somebody comes along and, you know, the AA, and they kind of know how a Ford Focus is wired and they've dealt with them before and all that sort of stuff. But if you get a call from a business owner, you've got to spend a lot of time in preamble saying, so what is it you do and what do you rely on and what's important and all that sort of stuff. So we rapidly sort of said, well, if we're going to bring lots of companies on doing this, it would be ideal if we knew a lot about them before they call us. And that's where you start getting into your planning. So if you sort of said, well, where's your business continuity plan? Where's this? Where's that? You know, where's give us a load of information about your business. So if you then call in a panic, one of our people will be looking at your pertinent information. So the equivalent of the firebox or whatever. So that's really where this whole concept came from. And then we sort of said, well, actually, you know, do you know what? Most people can't answer that question because they haven't actually got what we're looking for. They can't find it. So why don't we start by helping them find this stuff? So let's build a place where they can publish this information, keep it private but secure, and then other people can, you know, they can permission it to other people and to experts. So for example, they could click the select all and share it with us as a service provider, and then we're looking at the same information as them. So that's where our whole sort of platform idea came from. And then it's kind of been interacting with customers and them saying it would be really cool if it could do this, or I've got a need to do that, or it'd be awesome if you could do this for us. And then it's sort of grown from there, to the point where now, you know, if you were to have an incident or an accident or an investigation or whatever, you could then effectively throw the activity logging data from Track My Risks at the lawyers to prove your innocence or lack of culpability or whatever. Because it's everything that goes on in that platform is evidential. So yeah, that's kind of where it grew from, and we're used by about just under 3,000 companies now.
Wow.
In terms of live user accounts, not all for their sort of enterprise risk. Some of it is just, you know, I'm a main contractor, construction contractor, and I need to vet the insurance programs of 1,000 subcontractors and suppliers. So how do I ingest all that information securely, check it's all okay and authorize them? Well, that runs on our platform. We've just got a client coming in that are going to be certifying roofers for competence, roofing, you know, individuals. So that upload of all your qualifications and all that sort of in a structured way is going to happen on our platform. So we go everywhere from a school where we do absolutely everything to a much larger organization where there might be one little business process that runs on our platform. But it's all the same thing. It's uploading documentation in a secure, evidential way, making sure the right people can see it, and tracking the underlying sort of renewals and expiry dates that sit within each of those documents and reminding people that they need to do something again. You've got to do this thing again. You've got to formally approve it. You've got to renew your insurance or whatever it is, times 30, 40, 50,000 pieces of documentation across the platform. So, yeah, it's quite simple, really, but not simple to build and keep secure and sell and all those other things. But yeah, in terms of what it does, it's, you know, it's not rocket science in terms of the concept, I don't think.
Mm. So what would you say, like, the vision of Track My Risk, and what's the vision and values of what's your vision, I suppose? Is it that kind of to move forward onto that kind of breakdown cover as well, or is Track My Risk kind of
created? Well, probably more with a partner now, to be honest. I mean, I think we've got enough to do with the software. I think, you know, high level, the lofty goal is that, you know, we believe every organization should have a Track My Risks-esque system in place. Yeah. I would like it if everybody globally had a Track My Risks platform in place or an account in place, because that would be wonderful. But, you know, other people will come along. But the reason for doing that is we save people a lot of trauma, and hopefully we'll also prove that we save lives as well, because, you know, something is, it's going to be hard to pin down. But, you know, you would think if an organization is managing risk effectively, then it is less likely to fall under the proverbial bus in some way, and that could affect people's lives. It could also be a commercial thing to take people's jobs. You know, you don't get that regulatory fine, or, you know, you don't lose that large customer or whatever, because you've got your shit together. So that's kind of really where our focus is. So then it's all about distribution. It's about volume. It's about, you want to put 5,000 customers on the platform. Yeah, no problem. Let's agree a deal for doing that that isn't going to break the bank and is commercially viable, because it's a good thing that they do it. Not let's have Glaxo and Shell as customers, and each of them paying us, you know, £500,000 a year in license fees, and, you know, only a small number of companies can afford this kind of weird software. We're very much about, you know, if anybody listening to the podcast wants wants a platform to manage all this stuff at home, then yeah, feel free, send me an email and I'll spin you up an account, you know, and you can run your home life on it. That kind of thing. We're very relaxed about the price point and the engagement, because it really does help people. You know, so that's our strategy really. And I think if we can help people avoid incidents, accidents, mishaps by opening their eyes to something that they need to do, or reminding them that they need to do something again, then, you know, we've won. So we talked before about becoming the salesforce.com of risk, which is one of our early sort of strap lines, which we dropped. But, you know, that whole thing, if I want Salesforce, I can get it from, you know, whatever it is, 20 quid a month as a small business, right up to being GlaxoSmithKline globally. There's something for everybody. It's not just something for the rarefied few, because that isn't 99.9% of the working world, or the, you know, the consumer population.
Yeah, I like that. Like, one size kind of fits all. Not one size kind of fits all. We'll find a size that fits you, I suppose, is a better way to say it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's take something simple like employer's liability insurance, okay? So, you know, you employ people, you need employer's liability insurance, or you're breaking the law effectively. Well, so that's the same for a global multinational as it is for a two-man band. So if you've got that requirement and you need to retain that cover, evidence of that cover for, you know, 40 years into the future or whatever, well, how do all of those companies solve that problem? Well, they can put it in our platform, and every year they go in and replace it with the new one, and you build up a version history, which is secure. So in that sense, everybody can use our platform and could need our platform. Now, if I'm the two-man band in an unregulated industry, I might only have 10, 12, 15 things that I need to track over the life of the company. Whereas if I'm that multinational, that could be 20,000, 200,000. But it's the same underlying process. It's just a more complex hierarchy in terms of parent-child hierarchies and, you know, permissioning and all that sort of stuff. It's the same thing. It's no different to putting it in a network folder and tracking it on a spreadsheet and putting renewal dates in a diary. Or in a date column. It just automates that process and removes all the sort of the human, or most of the human error from the process in an evidential way. So it's actually quite simple. It's just about as organizations get larger and more complex, it just becomes a more complex implementation of the same underlying software. So yeah, that's where our implementation partners help with that, and they go in and sort of map the process and sort of say, well, what are you doing? So, you know, how are you coffee chain getting a copy of the, I don't know, food hygiene policy out to 500 stores simultaneously and checking that all of the managers have engaged with them? Well, you can do that with one push of a button through here, or you can use the internal mail and you can send people around auditing and doing all of that sort of stuff at great cost. It's up to you. So they're the sort of conversations we have with the larger companies.
Okay. Who do you find like coming to you, and when are they coming to you looking for this? So is it a safety professional? Is it normally the business owner or a responsible person? And then that's question one. And then I suppose question two would be, when are they coming to you? Is it always after an audit? Is it always after the fireman knocks on the door or the local authority knocks on the door? Or are we getting an increased appetite for this kind of digital revolution, I suppose?
Yeah, so to answer the second question first, because I'll probably forget the first one. we're seeing a bit of a sea change that I think a lot of people are now saying, look, you know, we've got to improve this process. For most organizations, there is a process that runs at the moment. It's just not particularly efficient. So a lot of it is a driver from, one company came to us the other day and said, look, you know, we've got 16 health and safety professionals, internal sort of audit health and safety people in the business. The manager of that team is looking to add on another four. Is there a way of using some technology that means that we don't have to expand the team at the moment? Could we become more efficient and get more out of the people that we've already got? So the answer is yes. So there's a cost driver to managing that compliance. We get a degree of companies or organizations that come to us that have failed some kind of inspection or have had a near miss. but they're not typically searching for what we do. So they might be more concerned around, so then normally they're introduced to us by people that know us. And then that's where your health and safety. So that one school, for example, failed an inspection on health and safety record keeping. They called in a consultant, health and safety consultant that specializes in schools. And he said, as a part of his recommendation, I suggest that you manage the controlled documentation and evidence on this platform. And then they called us and said, look, can we, and they've become a customer. So there isn't that sort of universal awareness at the moment, because I think most people's default reaction is, well, I'll go out and create another spreadsheet. And that tends to be the way that in small organizations it works. It's, I've got a spreadsheet with 150 rows on it. All of the headings, you know, are down there. The expiry or renewal date is in a column. And then I may or may not map that through to a network drive where the actual file is. And then they employ somebody to stare at the spreadsheet and hopefully not miss rows that have gone out of date. There was a case recently that's just going through the inquest of a little boy that was hit by a piece of cheese. Somebody threw a piece of cheese and he had an allergic reaction to it, tragically died. But as a part of that, the school had an EpiPen, so a steroid driver pen, to administer, and it turned out that was out of date, gone past its expiry date. And that, and the as a part of the evidence, they sort of talked about there was an error in the spreadsheet.
Right.
You know, somebody had put the wrong date into the spreadsheet, and then it hadn't. It's effectively the pen was a year out of date. Now, whether that actually contributed to the boy's death or not, I'm not sure, but it, to my mind, was something that was easily avoidable in terms of an admin error. You know, there was no oversight on it. Obviously, there was nobody checking the date. There was no photographic evidence of the box, which we would hold, and there was no automation of the reminder process to say to the parents, you need to send in another one because this one's expired. So there was a whole series of failings there, which are eminently avoidable if you've got the right technology and the right process. There's one of the problems we have, James, is that whenever you go into an organization, there are just so many things that we can help with. It's often a bit snowblinding, kind of, where the hell do we start?
Yeah.
So normally it's, okay, let's do gas safety certificates, or let's do fire risk assessments, or, you know, let's do your insurance documents, or whatever it is, depending on the size of the organization. And let's expand out from that core, because usually there's too much in too many pockets.
I might have a look for that case study of that little boy. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's a school in Ealing. If you look through my LinkedIn feed, you'll find it. They come up all the time. There was there was a scandal in York, I think, at York City Council a year or so ago, where they had a whole bunch of unlicensed taxi drivers. And I'm pretty sure that was due to somebody missing the renewal dates in the spreadsheet for whatever reason, and nobody knew. And then it all blew up. Something happened, and people hadn't been licensed for years, but they were driving around being taxi drivers, you know. And it goes on and on and on. In every organization we see, there's this massive unmanaged risk, potential risk. And you just think, guys, come on, wake up. We can sort this now. Let's just get it done. Move on. Because it will blow up in somebody's face at some point.
Definitely. That's an interesting one from a causation point of view. From civil law, they would look at that EpiPen from a causation point of view, I think. Like, so did the fact that they didn't have that EpiPen cause the young boy to pass away? Or was it the fact that the cheese was thrown caused the child to pass away? That'd be an interesting case. Okay, so I suppose, if I'm listening to this podcast and I'm thinking, wow, you know, Matt sounds and Track My Risk sound like that's what I need. How do they find you? How do they find Track My Risk? What does that look like, that process? How can they find out what Track My Risk look like?
Okay.
Before they spend their money?
Yeah, well, no worries. So trackmyrisks.com is the website, and there's videos on there, and there's contact us buttons and the screenshots and all that sort of stuff. You know, for me, I'm all over LinkedIn. I think I'm the only person with my name. So it's Matt Hodges-Long. So if you find that person, then that's me, typically, at Matt3TE on Twitter. And just hit me up and let's chat, and then we'll demonstrate to you. And sort of really what we need to do to for organizations is sort of understand the use case, and then we'll demonstrate that use case in real time, because it can vary massively in terms of what, you know, people are trying to achieve. You know, if you want to be opening up accounts to all of your staff, for example, because you want to put their health and safety training records and compliance training records on there around the person, or you want to do customers, or you want to do business units, these can all be set up really easily. So we'll demonstrate it. So yeah, just hit me up. Even if you completely disagree with what I'm talking about, always happy to chat. Engage on LinkedIn. Not shy in coming forward on and things of interest on LinkedIn. Always open to new connections. So yeah, let's talk.
Awesome. And I suppose it would be good to, would it be good for the your future customers to kind of know their biggest risk, to be able to pick that one thing to focus on, like you said earlier about gas, or would that be part of the conversation that you would have with them anyway?
It could be part of the conversation. I think most people often know. It depends on the level of, you know, if I'm dealing with a health and safety team within an organization, they kind of know what's going on. If I'm dealing with somebody that's an accountant that kind of been thrown the hospital pass of kind of, you know, you're now in charge of, you know, fire risk assessments or whatever, then often they need a bit more guidance. And then typically what we would do then is we would introduce them to people from our network that can actually go and do that work for them. You know, I'm not going to go and do a fire risk assessment, but if somebody needs one, I'll point them at the right people to go and help them. So it's sort of, it's a reciprocal sort of thinking about private people that are in private practice, you know, that might be introducing Track My Risk to their clients are also going to receive requirements from us in terms of new work, for we will have clients from other areas that need their help, and so it goes around. So we'll guide them through it and understand what the use case is, and then typically we will have managed that use case before, and then we can sort of show that operating, and sort of within 20 minutes, half an hour, it's up and running. You know, it's that quick. It's not weeks or months, or you know, it's a matter of minutes to actually sort of show what is currently a spreadsheet process or a manual process, showing that it's automated. So, you know, that's simple. We rarely have to say no, let's put it that way.
Oh awesome, that's awesome. Thanks, Matt. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast as well.
No worries, it's been really good, and look forward to hearing it.
Okay guys, I hope you found that useful. There's quite a lot of value bombs in there. If you like this podcast, give us a share. I know you don't want to admit you listen to Health and Safety podcast, but it's good, right? Come on, there's a lot of value bombs in there. Give us a share. Hit like and subscribe. If you're on iTunes, give us a rating and a review. If you leave us a review, give it a screenshot and share it on Twitter at Rebranded Safety. Let us know so we can give you a shout out. Thanks for listening, guys. See you next week. Safe.